Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're talking again about the Kingdom of God. We're starting a series. It'll probably be a 10-20 part series on the beast in Revelation and the mark of the beast and the little beasties that make this all come about in confronting the beast. So, how do you do that? What is that all about? What is all this thing about revelations and prophecies, etc.? There's actually a website, the big list of false prophets, and they have a list of all kinds of prophets like Piazza Smith and Moses David, who is also known as David Berg, and Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, the guru who predicted all kinds of worldwide communist dictatorship would be established in 1993 and Christ would return to earth. You know, there's all these different prophecies. They even mentioned David Koresh, and I'm trying to think of some of the other Vortex of the Star of David, religious sect, and Dan Millar, and numerous other prophets and prophetesses who are all talking about the future and what's going to happen, and most of their predictions have come and gone, and they were all false, or seemingly all false. I mean, you could say, wait a minute, there is a communist dictatorship gone worldwide. It's called the New World Order. It's been here already. Every single country in the world is a socialist nation now. They have different forms of socialism, but they're all socialists. And basically, that's what communism is socialism. I mean, you could, the communist Russia and communist China are identical, but they are all socialists. And socialism has taken the world by storm. Every single country in the world today is a socialist nation. And socialism has now become a good thing. And to even talk against it, you start hearing growls from the gallery. They don't like it. They don't want you to talk against it. Most Americans don't even know how socialistic they've become and when they all started becoming socialistic. Public school, public education, which is a phenomenon of the last century, because before the 1900s, most people in America were not educated in public schools. Public schools were a minority of schools, and even the public schools back then were heavily financed by private donations. And so the idea of public education is really fairly recent in American history. But it's socialistic. Public schools is socialism. It's compelling your neighbor to pay for your child's education at the point of a gun. Legally, because you don't own your property, and so they can tax your property now. You only have a legal title to your property. It's not what Americans came here to actually own, land that could not be taxed. And that someone who owned land that could not be taxed was someone who was referred to as landed. They actually owned it. And they were also called freemen. A freeman, by definition, even in the Oxford Dictionary today, is someone who owns the land itself. That means land untaxable. If you're paying tax on land, you're renting. Stop paying rent and see how much you own it, because you don't own it. Now, you don't like to hear that. I know a lot of Americans don't like to hear that. But that's just the way it is. I'm not making it up. Don't pay your taxes for 3, 4, 5 years, depending on what state you're in. And they'll take the land away from you. In Oregon, they nullify your ownership. And they take it and they sell it and they keep all the money. Many states keep all the money when they sell your land. I told a story not too long ago on the radio about a lady who was, I think it was like $6. She was short on what she owed in taxes. And that was a fine. That wasn't actually the tax. She had paid all the tax, but she didn't pay part of one of the fines that were imposed on her. She owned the land outright, or owned the legal title, correctly speaking here, owned the legal title outright. Her husband and her had paid it off. Her husband got sick and he died, and she was left a widow. And she fell behind on paying the taxes. She was barely making ends meet. She had to go to work, and it was rough. She's a widow, and they didn't have, a lot of savings. I think a lot was eaten up by medical expenses when her husband died. I mean, just funerals alone will impoverish a lot of people. But she eventually got caught up on her back property taxes and was able to pay it, working hard. But she missed $6 fee that she evidently had failed to pay because it was a late fee kind of thing. And they sold her land at auction. And somebody else bought it. It was worth about $250,000. They bought it for, like, I think $160,000. Because she was missing $60. And the new owner said he would be glad to step away and not keep the land if she would just pay him back the $165 that she paid to the state to buy the land. Now, this all went on right in the midst of hundreds of churches throughout the state, thousands of people claiming to be Christians, and this lady was robbed of her land, robbed of the legal title to the land, because she didn't own it. But it was legally robbed. It's not a violation of law. It was in accordance with law. They may have found a technicality, and eventually she, after years of fighting this in court, which cost her thousands of dollars, she may be about to get the land back. But why did she have to go through this? Why was she so brutally assaulted by the government? Because of $60 in fines, not $60 in failure to pay taxes, but fines. Because you live in a socialist nation that is up to its earlobes in greed. And people want their benefits, and they want them now, and they don't want to wait for them in line. Because we have bred a nation of selfish, covetous people. Now, you all out there, you're not all coveting your neighbor's goods, and you're not all selfish, and some of you are literally walking saints, I'm sure. But probably not as many as would like to think so. The reality is that the nation is being weakened. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about articles written by people on Mises. And we're going to talk more about some of these predictions that come about. You know, I could just go all the way down. Supposedly there's an Edgar Cayce predicted that the Earth would have a new pole during the winter of 1997 to 1998. Since the Earth spins like a gyroscope, this would take an enormous amount of energy to achieve. That amount of energy would cause massive disruption to the oceans and Earth's crust that could in turn cause very serious worldwide tidal waves, earthquakes, and volcanic eruptions. Well, last I looked at my calendar, 1998 came and went. So evidently the date was wrong. Will that eventually happen anyway? Probably. I mean, just looking at geomorphology, eventually things like that will happen. I was talking with my son earlier this morning when he was headed out to work, and we were talking about some of these things, and I said, I predict there will be an earthquake somewhere, sometime, in this planet. That's a pretty easy prediction to cover, but exactly when, pretty hard to tell. I've seen some remarkable predictions of earthquakes by just observing events on the sun, and were remarkably accurate because of the theory of reflective resonance, that what happens on the sun happens on the earth. And so when they see certain disturbances on the sun, they'll also see them on the earth. And the same thing seems to appear on other planets, and it's magnified by events that connect the planets to the sun. And so there is a certain amount of analytical predictability of things like earthquakes or storms or what have you. And you can predict the future based on observations in the present. How accurate is this? Well, observations aren't perfect, and things are not always as accurately contrived as we would like to think our brains are capable of doing. But we are always anxious to know the future and what's going to happen. How do you know the future? How do you know if the visions this fellow has is true and correct? Hong Ming Jin, who founded God's Salvation Church in Texas, the group believes that a nuclear war will destroy parts of the earth in 1999, which has come and gone, and it didn't happen. So he evidently was wrong. Michael Drosnin, author of the Bible Codes, founded Hidden Message in the Pentateuch, you know, the first five books of the Bible, that predicted that the World War III, involving worldwide atomic holocaust, would start in 2000, or perhaps 2006. Well, both those dates have come and gone, and it did not occur. So, who do we believe? William Cooper, head of the militia group in St. John's, Arizona, predicted that on this date of 2000, January 1, a secret chamber of the pyramid at Giza will be opened. Its secrets will be revealed, and Satan will become a public figure. The American militia will engage in massive war at this time, and this and the previous predictions are only two that we have been able to find which agree on the same day. Of course, it is an obvious date to select because most people believe that the next millennium begins then, on January 1st, 2000. And it starts 1 year later in 2001, January 1st. So, but both those dates have come and gone, and we don't seem to have seen this. I actually have some firsthand knowledge about the pyramid at Giza and a chamber that was discovered under the Sphinx. It was discovered by Boris Said, who was kind of a Indiana Jones type figure. He was a producer of shows about the pyramids with Charlton Heston narrating. His son is a famous race car driver. If you Google the name Boris, spelled like said, he and several other archaeologists and authors went to the Giza Plateau and were using testing equipment to examine the density of the rock on the Giza Plateau to see if there were any hollow spots, and they found one under the pyramid, under the Sphinx. And the Sphinx is apparently much older than the pyramids themselves. The erosion on the Sphinx is much different than the erosion that you see on the rocks of the pyramid. If you take close-up pictures of the erosion and you showed it to almost anyone who is a geologist, they would tell you that this erosion is due to rainfall, large amounts of water washing over the Sphinx, until you back up and show them that the Sphinx is the Sphinx and not just the rocks that you're showing them the picture of. And then as soon as they realize it's in the desert, they say, oh no, well that must be something else. That's not water, because there's not supposed to be any water in the desert. But supposedly the Sphinx was built long before the pyramids, and the reason the pyramids are partially there is because the Sphinx was there. And the Sphinx was discovered. And there's all kinds of ancient legends and writings that have been discovered that talk about the king that may have built this being Cheops. And, And then some people relate Cheops as actually Job. And he, when wandering in the desert, discovered the Sphinx and then began this process of building the pyramids, which was eventually finished by one of the pharaohs. And then there's all kinds of rumors about all these cities that were built and the stones that are impossible to move and the size of the stones and the guys who are predicting that all these things were obviously levitated into place because there was no way possible that they remove and move these stones and quarry these stones. And the reality is they leave all kinds of bits and pieces out of their puzzle because they actually find the tools, they find the methods, they even find the description of how they move the stones. And I love this old pyramid, which was a program put on by the same people who produced this old house. And they took a stonemason from New England who went over there and said, you know, cutting these stones and moving them, no big deal. It's just work. And most of your scholastic archaeologists don't know what it's like to do work with heavy equipment. I mean, with heavy materials like stones, not using heavy equipment. And it was just a very interesting show with the personalities butting heads because the intellectual had deciphered what he imagined to be the reality of how the pyramids were built. And it simply wasn't, it simply isn't the way it was. And then you go to Easter Island and all these other places and that, you know, obviously extraterrestrial, like Danigan writes his book, you know, Chariots of the Gods, that every painting, rock carving there is, it's before you know it, he's turning into alien spaceships and flying saucers or what have you, and obviously this, that, and the other thing, and it's not so obvious. And when people who actually go and investigate this examine it, they find out that's not true. This is common. This is the way these things happen, and this is the way they built these things, and here's the tools, and here's people who live on the island still know how to do these things, and you know, but they look at the pieces of the puzzle and they come to a conclusion of what they think the truth is, and it's not usually the truth, it's made up. And you get the same thing in lots of other areas of knowledge where people are calculating that this thing is so because of this and this is so because of that, but they leave out pieces of the puzzle, or they simply believe that this thing fits with that thing and therefore this is the conclusion. But the reality is they don't really fit together. They don't prove one to the other. Danigan is a prime candidate for this. Same way with the archaeological soothsayer tells us all about Planet X coming. And he does all these translatings, and this is this, and the Anunnaki and all that stuff. When you actually examine the materials, it doesn't quite fit. You know, he's making leaps of logic. And many of the things that would absolutely begin to fit together and prove that what he is saying is true simply don't fit together. And therefore, what he's saying may not be true. Then you have the people, when I first heard about things like Nibiru and I started investigating it, there were all kinds of people out there who were saying that they spotted it here and spotted it there, and you know, they were channeling information from this side of the universe or something, I don't know. And it was jumping all over the place. And people were listening. People were listening to it because they want to know what the answer is, because it gives them an edge, because they're actually insecure and they're afraid. And they don't know really what is going to happen, but they want to know so bad that they want to, the guy with the most convincing argument is the guy they want to believe. They just want to believe what he has to say because they want to believe that they have the edge because it gives them a sense of security. It gives them a sense of safety. And it actually makes us less safe because we aren't relying on our own personal revelation. We're going to talk a lot about how you recognize true revelation and not just in other people. It's pretty easy to tell whether somebody's a minister of God or not. But the fact is, you know, actually, I really shouldn't say it's pretty easy because almost any of the criteria that you use is going to be intellectually applied. The only way you can really tell if somebody is seeing the truth or the prophecy or what's going to happen or whatever is that you see it too, that you actually see it. Now, one of the things, though, that you should use always is a litmus test of whether or not you see the future or the truth or revelation or understand the situation or whatever it is that you're trying to decipher to know whether this is right or wrong or true or whatever, is that it is not accompanied by fear. One prophet fellow who was around for quite some time, I remember hearing Denyon Brinkley, and you know, he was, I think he was the guy who was struck by lightning while he was on the telephone. I may have that wrong, but anyway, he began to see certain things, and he predicted all kinds of stuff, and he had scenes from World War III, and came to life before me, he says, and I was in 100 places at once, and you know, all these kind of things, and everybody goes, wow, wow. It was kind of like, if you ever listened to Art Bell, Art Bell could speak on the radio and he would get all kinds of people who were telling them all kinds of things, and he would listen to them and you would hear like, oh my goodness, oh really? And I don't really believe I think he thought the guy was a total wacko, but it was copacetic with the guy. So and he would play the news announcer, but he kept a lot of truckers awake and saved lives by doing so. But when we come back, let's talk about how do you know what you know is true. We'll be right back and we'll talk about that.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Jefferson did not write, they are endowed by their constitutions with unalienable rights. Nor did Jefferson write, they are endowed by their elected lawmakers with unalienable rights. Jefferson did write that these truths are self-evident. Does that mean we have to go to school to learn these truths from a teacher? Does self-evident mean we have to read, study, and research these ideas in books written by other men? No, these truths are written on our conscience, on our hearts and minds, written on our souls by our Creator. These truths are maxims of His law. If unalienable rights are endowed, granted, or given by our Creator to each of us, does that mean that there is no free will choice, act, or deed that can bar us from access to these God-given unalienable rights? Is it a self-evident truth that we can freely choose to do anything, and we will always maintain access to these natural law, unalienable rights endowed by God. Isn't it a self-evident truth that the answers to these questions are no? Isn't it also a self-evident truth that in order to maintain access to the inalienable rights granted by God, that we must also maintain our God-given natural law responsibilities and duties in order to maintain our position or status in God's government or jurisdiction? Don't the governments of man require obedience to their laws in order to keep their civil rights? Why would it be any different for God? If we want to keep his inalienable rights, wouldn't we be expected to keep his laws, do his will by remaining obedient, loyal, and giving allegiance to him and his government? If an individual, family, community, or nation freely chooses by consent, participation, or appeal to create or join a different government that has its own structure and form, which creates its own civil laws, and grants its own civil rights to its members, persons, nationals, or citizens, doesn't the act of joining, giving allegiance, obedience, trust, and faith to this new government mean that they have rejected the Creator's government and rejected His laws? Doesn't it mean that the people have rejected God and His ways, and in essence, expatriating their natural status as a national in God's kingdom government, in order to be naturalized into a new government created by men via consent, contracts, constitutions, participation, and appeal? Isn't this what happened to the Israelites when we read 1 Samuel chapter 8? So how does an individual, a family, a community, a nation once again get access to their God-given inalienable rights once they have lost them by their own free will choices, acts, and deeds? Repent. Turn around. Go the other way, God's way. Start taking back the responsibilities that are imposed on the nationals of God's kingdom government. Responsibilities do not follow rights. Rights follow responsibilities. The first step is to truly love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and to love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. If we want our God-given unalienable rights back, we must stop exercising dominion over our neighbors. Start keeping the commandments. Do not covet. Do not steal. Which includes the legalized covetousness and plunder that is mandatory in all man-made governments. Start by coming together in free will assemblies of individuals and families that are seeking to return to God's kingdom government. Families and individuals start by seeking, striving, and working to be the departments of health, education, welfare, economy, defense, agriculture, energy, and justice for other families in the free assembly, but also for other families of families near and far. The Creator is the God of the living, not the God of the dead. His kingdom was, is, and will be forever on earth as it is in heaven. Start by connecting and finding other kingdom-seeking families on the His Holy Church Living Network. Visit www.hisholychurch.org to start your journey back to your unalienable birthright.
Hi, I'm Brent. I'm a contact minister for the Living Network in Northeast Missouri. You're not the only one out there with the desire to learn the truth. There are people all over the world coming together in faith, hope, and charity. Join us at one of the upcoming gatherings to meet new people, fellowship, work, and play. Whether it's the Fall Burning Bush Festival in Oregon or the Spring Gathering in Northeast Missouri, you'll get all the details when you join the Living Network. Go to hisholychurch.org and click on the network link. Find out what you've been missing. You'll be glad you did.
Well, welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom, and we're talking about prophecy, predictions, the future, the past, and in the past, most prophets were wrong. They just got it wrong. It isn't what was going to happen, it didn't happen, and they had the dates wrong. One of my favorite prophets is a fellow who's been around for a long time, is Harold Camping, who's president of Family Radio, and he predicts stuff all the time into the world. May 21st, September 29th of 2011, just goes on and on, and he's wrong, and then he comes out with another prediction and everybody listens. Hello, he got it wrong again. I always remember I think it was one of the Ghostbusters shows, Bill Murray had somebody on his talk radio show that was actually predicting the future, which was going to be the future of Bill Murray, because of the fact that this guy was seeing the future of the Ghostbusters and what they were going to be doing. And Bill Murray, of course, was putting it down in his comedic way. And one of the things that he put down is, he says, well, his prediction is way too soon. I mean, his book's not even going to go into the second printing, and they're going to know he's a fraud. And because he assumes that everybody's a fraud, because he was always a fraud. But anyway, the reality is, I like the predictors, the guys who are predicting stuff that is in 2064. Because they will have already retired and passed away by the time the prediction gets there. But other people are not quite so bright, and they're predicting stuff in the very near future. And of course, now we can sit back and read 2010. In early 2005, Roderick C. Meredith, leader of the Living Church of God, wrote the church magazine Tomorrow's World, that the end of the world is near, he said, and that events prophesied in the Bible are beginning to occur with increasing frequency. We are not talking about decades in the future. We are talking about Bible prophecy that will intensify within the next 5 to 15 years. Well, it may be true, because we're only a little over 7 years into that prediction. But it hasn't happened yet, at least not the way he says. But I can tell you this, that there will be economic woes in the future. I don't need a crystal ball to tell you that. There will be earthquakes in the future, and there will be wars in the future. I can tell you all that. But the end of the world, what is that? Where does this idea that the end of the world is coming? Now, it's been around for a long time, and we can go to the Bible, and even in the Old Testament, it talks about the end of the world. In Psalms 19:4, it says, their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them has he set a tabernacle for the sun. They're not talking about the end of the planet. They're just talking about to the other side of the planet, you know, to the other side of inhabited places is actually the Hebrew word that they're using there. But if you read down in Matthew, there's also the same kind of thing going on in Isaiah 62:11. But in Matthew 13:39, it says, the enemy that sowed them in the devil, the harvest is the end of the world, and the reapers are the angels. And he's talking about prophecies, the messengers. The reapers are the messengers. The messengers are the reapers. That is a really important concept. And I have not, all the biblical studies and all the prophets and prophets for prophets that I have read don't understand why the messengers are the reapers. And that is a basic principle of spiritual law. I read this morning, I was up early about 2 o'clock, and I read a lot of stuff by someone who is let's just say they're a minister under a vow of poverty, and they work for a large church, and they seem to be a rather, you know, nice person, and maybe a very kind person, and they understand canon law. They understand its history. They've studied it. They've got degrees in it, and they've read it in Eastern Orthodox and in the different synods and divisions that have taken place over the centuries, canon law. But they seem to miss some very important fundamentals. One thing is that from the beginning, there were preachers coming into what was the church appointed by Jesus Christ and bringing in damnable heresies. And one of them is that there should be a hierarchy of authority in the church. Some sort of hierarchy of exercising authority within the church. Anyone who thinks that is opening the door to the Antichrist, because that is Antichrist. When Jesus said, "These are the ones that were with me in my temptations," what was his temptation? The temptation was to exercise authority, one over the other. Christ had more right to exercise authority than anybody. He was the highest son of David. He was the king of Judea. He did issue certain edicts and commands when he was in the Gastophone, the royal treasury. But that was his job to, as king, he was to fire the money changers if they were corrupt. He could not, as king, elect new ones. It wasn't his place to elect new ones. He even tells us to his apostles, "It's not given to me to say who's going to sit in this position or that position." If it wasn't given to Jesus, it wasn't given to anybody else. Not as some central authority that can appoint people from the top down, because that's not the way the kingdom works. The kingdom of heaven begins within you, and your neighbor, and your neighbor's neighbor, and your neighbor's neighbor's neighbor. That's where it begins. So who sits higher in the kingdom is he who serves the best. And he who serves the best is determined by those who say, "This is my minister. This is my servant." And 10 families pick a servant to serve, to be a mediatory agent of Jesus Christ. A mediatory agent of Christ, we'll say. And I have some articles coming up that will mention that, this idea of a mediatory agent of Christ. That's what a minister is. He never stands between you and Christ. He doesn't mediate between you and Christ. But he's a mediatory agent of Christ, providing a service and the transference of wealth from one group of people to the needy, the righteous needy, the worthy poor. That's the job of the minister. Always been the job of the minister since the days of Abraham, even actually back, if you go far enough back, to the days of Enoch. A minister of God was to do the work of God for the people by the offerings of the people for the benefit of the people. And they did it by free will offerings, by choice. Choice remained with the individual. So as the kingdom of God is within you, and you receive the divine revelation of God, you will be able to pick your minister and give to him to fulfill, to help fulfill. I mean, you have a duty to God and your fellow man. That's what religion is, your duty to God and your fellow man. I'm going to repeat that over and over again. You'll hear that from me over and over again, because you don't hear it from anybody else. It used to be written in the dictionary as the definition of religion. Even at the time of Christ, you can find dictionaries that state that that's the definition of religion. But there's another definition that comes along. It's what you think about God is supposed to be religion. If you think God's name is Allah, then that's your religion. If you think God's name is Yahweh, then that's your religion. If you think God's name is Yah, then that's your religion. If you think God's name is Elohim or Jehovah, that's your religion. If you think his character fits this, that's your religion. But that's not what religion was. Religion was how you fulfilled your duty to God and your fellow man. Now, why God and your fellow man? Because God said you should love your neighbor as yourself, and therefore that's your duty. So in order to do that, to love your neighbor as yourself, you may need to have somebody help facilitate that love, because you get busy. And so you empower somebody to help fulfill your duty to your fellow man. And that's what socialism is. You're empowering somebody to take care of the needy of society. That's what socialism is. But socialism takes an extra step. In socialism, you have empowered somebody to compel you to contribute to the welfare of your neighbor and everybody else in your socialist system. In God's system, you maintain your right to contribute. You make that daily choice. God is a God of choice. He gives you a choice. Give, not give. Freely give, not freely give. Freely receive, not freely receive. That's your choice. Because in that choice, I mean, you think about it, raising your kids. If you give them choices to make, they learn to make choices. If you take away choices, they never learn to make choices. I remember some very restrictive parents who never let their kids make choices and restricted them quite a bit. And when, as soon as their kids were out on their own, they went, God got crazy, doing all kinds of things. When their parents were gone for the weekend, they were trying to sneak around behind their parents' back and do things that their parents didn't know. I mean, there was some of that even in my own family. The least rebellious of my children was actually doing a lot of things in secret. was not really a bad kid, but he did do some stuff that he shouldn't have been doing. But that's part of that choice. Some of those things I knew about. And still to this day, some of those things I know about, and he doesn't know I know about. And I'm not giving it away. But choice. God wants you to have choice, so you should want your children to have choice, because in giving them the chance to make choices, they learn. But how do you make those choices without divine revelation? Now we're back to that end of the world in Matthew 13:49. So shall it be at the end of the world. So everybody says, oh my goodness, there's going to be an end of the world. And then we see in Matthew 24:3, he sat upon the Mount of Olives, and the disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the signs of thy coming and of the end of the world? Oh my gosh, he's talking about the end of the world too. And teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. Amen. That's in Matthew 28:20. So those are all in Matthew. I don't see anything mentioning the end of the world in Luke or Mark or John. We do see it mentioned again in Hebrews in 9:26, for then must he often have suffered since the foundation of the world, but now in the end of the world hath he appeared to put away sin by sacrifice of himself. Put away sin already in the end of the world. What end of what world? What is going on here? It's already happened. He's put away sin at the end of the world. And did you know that there's two words in that Hebrews that are both translated into world? They have no connection whatsoever. They are not the same words at all in the Greek. They are completely different words. So when he talks about the foundation of the world, he's talking about the organized system or constitutional order or government. That's what that word means. And that's usually created by the concept contained in another Greek word, kamizo, which means to take care of. The systems of the world are often created by offering benefits to the people, to take care of them, to take care of their needs. And by people applying for that benefit, they become a part of the world, the constitutional order, system of government, whatever it is that they have organized. But the end of the world phrase that we see there in that verse, and also in Matthew 28:20 and 24:3 and 13:49, that's not the same word for world. That's not the end of the constitutional order and system of government. Although that system, which is tied to the idea of the unrighteous mammon, which means entrusted wealth, doesn't mean money, it means entrusted wealth, that is evidently going to fail. And they always have. Anyone who predicts this, I predict that the United States government will fail. When? I don't know. But it will fail. They all do. They all eventually decay and collapse and fail. It's not even the same government that it was 200 years ago. It's different. Vastly different. The relation of all the people to it is vastly different. So whatever existed in 1798 doesn't exist anymore as it did in 1798. Something else is existing in its place. Maybe still called the same thing, but everybody's relationship to it has changed. Its relationship to everybody else has changed. Its power has changed. All these things have changed, and you really can't go back to the way it was because you're not back there anymore. You've changed. The people have changed, you know. Now, if you want to go back to a state of liberty and freedom that once you enjoyed and you don't seem to enjoy anymore, well, then you have to change first. You have to be the change you want to see in the world. I think Gandhi said that. People said that about Gandhi. But anyway, what is this end of the world? The word world there in all those verses is the same Greek word, but it's not the Greek word that means inhabited places. It's not the Greek word that means planet. It's not the Greek word that means constitutional or system of government. So what word does it mean? It means time. It's aeon. It means an age, a period of time, a long period of time. When they talk about the end of the world in the Bible, every single place you see it in the New Testament, they're talking about the end of an age. That's what they're talking about. They're not talking about anything else but the end of an age. What happens when you end an age? When you end one age, what is it that takes place? Well, I can tell you what takes place. Another age. That's what happens. When one age ends, another one begins. And that's just the way it is. It always has been that way, and there's no reason to believe that it isn't. Now, that people talk about new heaven and new earth. Well, the earth has been renewed several times. The flood, after the flood, there was a new earth. The earth was under a new set of rules, a new system. You know, if we look at Luke 1:33, we see that same word, age, but it's translated as ever. And it says, and he shall reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. Well, wait a minute. If the world is in, has the kingdom ended? Because the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So does it end? No, it doesn't really. And we can go through world without end. Age without end. That's actually what they say in Ephesians 3:21. It's that same word, age again. Throughout all ages, it says. And then it says world, which means ages without end. Amen. And we see these same things going on in other verses. But we won't bore you with that. We'll get on to what we were talking about before. How do you know when Revelation is real? How do you know that these prophets are not just prophets for profit, and that they are actually seeing something in the future, something that you may need to know? And that they are actually accurate. Because I can go through long lists of guys who were not accurate and did not know, but made a lot of money telling people that this is the way it's going to be. I mean, we have a prediction in 2016 there will be a virus that will suddenly begin to spread in the planet and will eventually kill all humans on the whole planet. And now, I think that's quite a prediction. It came from the Donner Party, supposedly. A fellow, Professor Lloyd Cunningdale from Salt Lake, was excavating there and supposedly found a time capsule with this prediction in it. And he's telling everybody that there will be this sweeping disease that will kill everybody. Everybody on the planet, which is a real bummer. You know, we don't even get the survivor things. But there's a fascination in the subconscious of man with destruction. Countdowns to destruction. Like the nightmare for everyone and the countdown to 2000. It predicted that sometime before 2018, asteroids and comets will hit the Earth. And between their recreation of Israel in 1948 and 2018, well, they're running out of time. But the reality is, just like the recent comet that was coming, there was all kinds of predictions about that. I would get them in my emails, and then most of them so far have not come to pass. And those guys will be at it next year with new predictions. We're supposed to be listening to. But one thing that I did happen in skimming through a lot of these guys earlier this morning, just so that I'd be able to share some of these things with you, Brinkley had said in one place, he said, talking to this being of light that was giving him information, the fear these people are feeling is an unnecessary one, said the being of light, but it is a fear so great that humans will give up all freedoms in the name of safety. Well, Benjamin Franklin said the same thing hundreds of years ago, and he wasn't necessarily a being of light. It's just an observation that people fear can grip you so much that you will do almost anything. And I've watched recently a drama amongst people where fear and anger were constantly present in almost everything that was being said, even when they quieted down and were saying things supposedly in a logical tone. There was a strain of fear behind what they were saying, and you have to kind of step out of the situation. Don't get enmeshed in the drama and the energy of control or anger or fear. And you watch, and you'll see that many comments that people make, and many statements they make, and many ideas that they come up with are interlaced with these threads of fear and anxiety. Fear and anger, same thing. You see anger, you're seeing fear, and you're seeing one side of the coin of fear. The other side is flight, and this side is fight, but it's all part of the same event. And those events are all born out of the fact that God is not dwelling fully within you. I say fully, but he's basically not in wherever that's coming from. Because God does not move from fear and anger. He comes with light and calmness of being. So anytime you see that fear, know that this is false prophet. If he is feeding the fear, it is a lie. So beware of that. But we're going to talk in great detail and depth about these predictions in the shows to come. So be there on Keys to the Kingdom. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net. Thank you.